Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to another new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm one of your co-hosts, Shobana Xavier. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I hope you are all safe and well. In each new book of New Books in Islamic Studies, we feature an author of a new book that has been published and is relevant to the field of Islamic studies as it's broadly defined. And today we have with us Kiara Formiki, who is the Associate Professor in Southeast Asian Studies in the Department of Asian Studies at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Challenging the geographical narrative of the history of Islam, Kiara Formiki's new book, Islam in Asia, A History, which is published by Cambridge University Press, helps us to rethink how we tell the story of Islam and the lived expressions of Muslims without privileging certain linguistic, cultural, and geographical realities. Focusing on themes of reform, political Islamism, Sufism, gender, as well as a rich array of material culture, such as sacred spaces and art, the book maps the development of Islam in Asia, such as in Kashmir, Indonesia, Malaysia, and China, and much more. It considers both transnational and transregional ebbs and flows that have defined the expansion and institutionalization of Islam in Asia while attending to factors such as ethnicity, linguistic identity, and even food cultures as important realities that have informed the translation of Islam into new regions. It is the convergence and conversation between the local and foreign, or better yet, between the theoretical notions of center and periphery of Islam and Muslim societies that are dismantled in the book, defying any notions of Asian expressions of Islam as a derivative reality. The book is accessibly written and will be extremely useful in any undergraduate or graduate courses on Islam, Islam in Asia, or political Islam. The book will also be of interest to those who work on Islamic studies and Asia studies as well. In our conversation today, we spoke about the methodological process that took to write the book, as well as some of the historical realities of how Islam came to Asia, as well as discussions of Sufism and the ways in which the book can be deployed in undergraduate courses in your own classes. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Professor Kiara Formiki about her new book, Islam in Asia, A History.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us today. We have a tradition in New Books in Islamic Studies that we have asked the authors to share something about their intellectual journey and what brought them to writing their book. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what led you to writing this great book, Islam in Asia, and what got you interested in the topic.
Thank you. This is, on my end, this is always a kind of fun question of what brings you to a project or to an actual final fun product. So this book largely came out of my own frustrations as a student, a scholar, a teacher, and more personally, or, you know, as an art enthusiast. I'm not, definitely not an art expert, but I enjoy going to museums, and there was something about the way in which Islamic art and art from Southeast Asia never seemed to come together in any of the museums that I'd come to visit. And so over, at this point, almost 20 years, all these frustrations kind of culminated in Lucy, my amazing editor at Cambridge, finding me and asking me whether I wanted to write a book, largely based on my research interests and my methodological concerns or interests in bringing together Islamic studies and Asian studies. For me, this multi-pronged approach to my frustration was really important as I moved forward in thinking and writing the book, because as I felt that I experienced it from all sides. So as a student, I remember deciding to turn towards Southeast Asian studies as an Islamic studies major in Italy. And I was really left without much guidance and also a sense that was not very pleasant. A sense that my questions were beyond the pursuit of what Islamic studies stands for, because Indonesia was so far east that did not belong to what we were doing in the classroom. Then I moved on and I started working on my master's and then PhD in London, and researching political Islam and practices and ideas of Islamic statehood in colonial Indonesia, I came to realize that these realities were really excluded by broader discussions of Islamic statehood. And this was until the 2002 Bali bombings, which then was seen as a follow-up to the 9/11 attacks in New York City and D.C., and so brought the discussion over Islam in Indonesia under this new, maybe it's harsh to call it a new fad, but a new trend in thinking in terms of terrorism and connecting militant Muslims all over the world, one to the other, under the big label of the Taliban or Osama bin Laden's interest. So we went from a Gusean paradigm of Islam in Indonesia as ultimately syncretic and not really Islamic to these are the most fundamentalist Muslims we can find. And so that was my second layer of frustration. And then when I started teaching courses on Islam in Asia, both in Hong Kong and then later in the States, I really couldn't find approachable books to assign or even scholarship in general. When we get the student evaluations at the end of the semester, I would always get tons of comments like, there's too many readings, they're too hard, they're too dense, they're too specific. And so that was another element of figuring that there hadn't, it had been such a specialized discourse to think differently about Islam and Southeast Asia, or even Asia more generally, that I could find amazing scholarship, niche scholarship, specialized scholarship, but not something that I could assign my students, or that could be an entry point for people, colleagues and graduate students who were interested in rethinking these frameworks. And so ultimately, I'm just glad that something good came out of years of frustration. And the outcome of this was a book that I framed as wanting to impact, maybe shape, I don't know, that we all have very high hopes for our scholarship. But really the way in which these three sets of readers might approach the subjects of Islam in Asia in relation one to the other. So there's the Islamic studies people, the Asian studies people, and then general readers and students who are, nobody's a tabula rasa, but, they are as close as possible to that when it comes to scholarly debates and infights. It was a book that came out of frustration, ultimately. Yeah.
And I love that it was dedicated to your students. And I think that really kind of expresses what the intention of the book was and the accessibility and what you've produced. So I'm really excited to talk to you about it, and I'm glad that you did something with your frustration. Can you tell us a little bit about your methodological process? I'm always interested in hearing from scholars how they go about their methods in a book, and especially in a book like this where you are engaging in Islamic studies, in Asian studies. And I was really amazed with the pictures that you included, your engagement with material culture and primary sources as well. So what was that process like in bringing together these sources for this book?
So this is a great question. First of all, I think it took a lot of effort in managing my imposter syndrome, because I am, you know, throughout the book, about 80% of the time I'm outside of on my comfort zone, outside of the areas that I know best, both as an individual and as a scholar. So my primary, absolute, most niche way of thinking about my expertise is political Islam in late colonial Java. And, you know, that when you look at it in a book, it was really hard to limit it, but, you know, it's maybe, I don't know, 4 pages total of a 200 plus pages book. So it was, to me, there was a lot of mapping that had to happen, mapping up the scholarship, mapping up what questions to ask and how to answer them, especially to go back to the point that you made about accessibility. And I'm glad that you thought that was something that did come across, because I spent a lot of time thinking about my classroom experience as a teacher, literally going back to my notes, the syllabi, assignment questions, ways in which students answered my questions in their journals, or you know, little margins on the side. I'm very much a pen and paper person. You know, margins on the side of my class notes with questions the students have made through the session, to see what was important, what was harder to get through to them. So there was a classroom experience. There was identifying the you know, key questions and key nodes in both the Islamic studies scholarship and the Asian studies scholarship, and see how they have been or have not been talking to each other. And this was, you know, challenging, engaging, and exciting, elating, all of these different big feelings, let's say, all at the same time. Right before leaving sabbatical, I actually returned, I think it was more than 400 books to the library. And for months, I had just these piles and piles of books all over my office. And I actually took one of my graduate students' reading session to the university hotel's bar, because I couldn't fathom clearing my desks to make enough space for people to sit around. It's just like there was so much trying to figure out who was doing cutting edge scholarship. And there is this very large, I mean, isn't, maybe we'll return to this question, to this issue later on. I didn't think that I was really breaking new grounds in talking about Asia as an Islamized space or a space of Islamized interaction, but because there is so much really good in-depth niche scholarship that allows me to make this larger approach argument, but it's so niche that often gets lost, and people in adjoining fields are not aware of it. And so that was another really important aspect of the methodology, and sort of really going to the library and physically browsing through the books, going to random panels at conferences, and pinning friends and colleagues about what do you think is, you know, the most earth-shattering books that you have read recently that converse with long-established scholarship. And then there is the last bit of it, which is what you were pointing at in terms of seeing pictures that I've taken and references to the primary sources, was the fact that I didn't want this to be a book completely dissociated from the life experience of Muslims in Asia. It is a history book, but we all live, I grew up in Rome and in Bali, actually, two places where history is everywhere all the time. And so history is something that we can live, something that we can touch, something that we experience, we smell, we hear as we walk through. And this is not, I'm not making an argument for religions everywhere, in a conservative sense, in the sense that it's part of a place's landscape and soundscape. So some sections of the book, like the section of Muslim minorities, kind of draws from archival research I did in London on Muslims in Arakan or Rakhine State, today in Burma, Myanmar. There is everything that relates to colonial Indonesia and then the impact of the Iranian Revolution of 1979 on Indonesia and Southeast Asia broadly comes also from my original research in these places. But then there is also, as I was trying to say, this sense and this being able to live the things that I'm writing about, even though they're not my primary field of expertise. And so when I was working in Hong Kong, right before leaving, actually, I took a vacation trip through China. So we took the train out of Hong Kong and traveled all the way to the Tarim Basin in Xinjiang. And it was just amazing to see this kind of you know, living part of the Silk Road through which Islam and Muslims moved through the centuries, if not almost two millennia, and see the different architecture of mosques, different things that you buy in markets. And again, listening to the Azan in different contexts. It was also Ramadan. It was Xinjiang 2014. It was a very specific political context. But it was so... I felt so lucky to have that opportunity and at the same time to try and bring it through the pages. Again, I'm definitely not China expert, but I like to think that, that having had that experience, the life experience kind of brings something more to the book, to the scholarly, grounded, bookish, grounded narrative.
And I think that was definitely what is appealing about the book that I found, that that was the balance of, you know, the historical context, the primary context, and the lived reality. And I thought that was phenomenal. And it's one of the things that kept making me want to read more and more, knowing that you, like, you know, knowing that you had taken the pictures and knowing the ways in which you're engaging with these different dimensions. And I wonder if you could talk about some of these, both, you know, at a meta level, but also some of the broader aims or interventions that you're trying to make. And I think right now is an interesting time in Islamic studies. And, you know, there's all these interesting conversations going on Twitter and on listservs in terms of what is Islamic studies. And so it was interesting to read your book in that kind of context, because, you know, the main intervention that you are trying to make is getting us to reshift how we even, you know, chart or, you know, situate Islam in a geographical context. So can you help us to think about why this is such an important project in terms of trying to get people either in Asian studies or Islamic studies to rethink their projects and what they're doing and who they're having conversations with?
Thank you. Well, so I think that the first real problem is that there hasn't been a conversation for so very long. I mean, this is the separation of what we consider Islamic studies and what we consider Asian studies goes back to colonial times, and it was rehashed and reinforced in many places around the world. I mean, both in academic world, both in Europe and in the United States, by the way in which academic structures and academic fundings, institutions are organized. But we see a clear polarization in a way of an equivalence being made between Islamic studies as being grounded in out of the Arabic language scriptural sources and early historical experiences, but also more recent 20th century experiences in the larger Middle East and North African region, with North Africa also itself being often marginalized as being on the fringe. And Asian studies, when we enter the realm of religions, think of religious studies to think about Asian religions as Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, animism, all these traditions that were turned into isms during the colonial period. And we don't seem to have gotten beyond that. So going back to what I was hinting at in terms of museum galleries, if we think about the new Met galleries in New York City, the Louvre recently renovated Islamic art galleries, everything that belongs to the Islamic art category originates from the greater Middle Eastern region. And even when we talk about South Asia or Western China, it's with an eye towards, it's either with an eye towards, oh, these things look just like stuff that the people in the Middle East are doing, or this is so exotic. Of course, we don't use these terms anymore, but this subtext is so strong still now. And if you know students enrolling in classes on Asian religions are not exposed to Islam, but not even Christianity or Judaism, even though these are very important religious traditions that have been present in Asia for centuries. So I feel very torn because on the one hand, I feel that what I'm saying is not earth-shattering, as I said. I mean, my position doesn't even sound new to me anymore, but I'm constantly surprised, negatively, admittedly, by how the paradigm has just been held on to, both by Islamic studies scholars who work on the scriptures and Asian studies scholars who do not specialize on Islam and so think about Islam as a recent phenomenon and having to dig below the surface of Islam or Christianity in the Philippines, for example, to find, or China for that matter, to find the authentic religious tradition and spiritual tradition of these Asian peoples. I mean, it's so... I said I don't want to sound demeaning or disparaging in any way, but I sometimes find that much of the nuance that as scholars we're able to get lost in this broader classifications of Title VI fundings in the U.S., for example, or departmental historical framings. So what I'm really hoping for, and you know, this is a very high hope, and I feel that I'm putting my humble self aside. But what I'm really hoping to do, what I envision to do with this book, is to advance a clear enough image of Asia as a cohesive space of Islamized interaction. These are expressions that come up throughout the book, maybe too often, but to me, where easy, memorable expressions to get back to see how all these disparate historical, geographical examples feed into a broader conceptual framework in which there are no centers and no peripheries. So I think these four themes are, on the one hand, there is the intra-Asian connections. So this movement of people and ideas and goods, material objects that connected the east shore of the Mediterranean to the west shore of the Pacific, whether it was overland or by sea. Then there is this conversation between that which is transregional and then later transnational and the local. And this conversation sometimes is paused, you know, like an old couple that is no longer listening to each other. And sometimes it's very active, like it can be quarreling or it can be extremely engaged. But it's, in that sense, I think it's really like a conversation. Then we have the influences, the various influences that Muslims who originate from the so-called peripheries or live in the so-called peripheries, the ways in which they have influenced those at the center. If you could see me, you see a lot of air quoting here in terms of periphery, center, local, and all these categories. And then did you contextualize your orthodoxy or orthopraxy? So I think that there are these four major themes that through any single chapter, most at least you find three out of four in all of the chapters trying to pull and draw this hopefully vivid and imaginable picture of Asia as a cohesive space of Islamized interaction. And this doesn't mean that everybody was converting right and left. It just means that Muslims and certain practices that were somehow inspired by Islamic beliefs were everywhere. And these, and so going back to the big picture question, what I was really hoping was that by not just making a theoretical or approach argument devoid of historical geographical context, and this is such a niche argument that you can make for certain people who live at a certain time in a certain place, but instead drawing from historical examples from across Asia, very broadly understood, and across time, usually from the 9th century up to today, maybe I can shape or reshape, redirect the way in which Islamic studies people and Asian studies people, which are incidentally my people, I feel I have a very split identity here with training in both fields, can approach the subjects of Islam and Asia not as two separate entities, but actually as two subjects, objects, actors, arenas that have been talking to each other through the centuries, sometimes hearing each other, sometimes refusing to hear each other, but they are in relation one to the other. They're correlated.
And I think that's one of the things I really loved about the book, is that the story or the starting point is in Asia. And so what is it that we learn when we start there, as opposed to always ending there? Like, it seems to be very, like, the last point that some people might talk about when they are thinking about Islam. But this is like, no, we're starting the story here and we're going to tell the story fully. And I really appreciated that. For listeners who may not know, I know this may sound like a very basic question, but it's something that you addressed at the beginning. What's the expansion process of Islam to what we are speaking broadly about Asia? I know we don't have time to go into like details of the different nation states that you're dealing with, but broadly, in terms of like commerce, and you mentioned the Silk Road earlier, what was the process in which Islam came to Asia?
So this was this is chapter one, which I titled Islam Across the Oxus, and it was very daunting. So the time frame of that first chapter is from the 7th to the 17th century, to boil it down to an actually readable chapter of about 30 pages was was one of those challenges that that I was quite happy to undertake, because I do it in class every year. I spend the first two classes trying to delineate the boundaries, the literal geographical boundaries, and trying to undo what we think and what students think the boundaries of Islam and the boundaries of Asia are. So when I think in these terms, for me, it's important to center the story around Asia and realize that within even less than the first century from the revelation, Islam as a religious system, everyone referred to it in those terms, and Muslims as individuals had been living all over the known world, or the known all over the geography that was reachable through travel and trade. This is because as the Nestorian Christians, for example, had been present in India and other on the Indian subcontinent and other parts of Central and Eastern Asia already before the Muhammad's revelation, people were extremely mobile. We talk about globalization today, but of course we know that there is a phenomenon that was just called pre-modern globalization, So trade was an absolutely crucial element in the spread of Muslims, in the outward movement of Muslims. And here, but also being very careful to make a number of distinctions in terms of commerce versus military reach, but also the difference between individuals who we know or we have historical records or material records of conversion, and ways in which Muslim ideas and, again, practices that emerged from Islam percolated so many different arenas of individuals' lives and practices, especially when it comes to trade, for example, where we know that Islamic law has very specific requirements about how to conduct trade in an ethical and just manner, for example. Kind of trying to rein back into the original question.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think that commerce had the most impactful outcome in terms of the ways in which Islam arrived everywhere and Muslims arrived everywhere. The military expansion was in that frame extremely limited, both in geographical reach and impact. So as an undergraduate student, in Italy after in school, I learned all these things about the Crusades, but nothing about Islam. For me, one of the deepest revelations was to realize that the Arab garrisons were kept separate from the conquered people's quarters all over North Africa and the Middle East in the early, West Asia, in the early decades of the imperial expansion, and that conversion was not encouraged because what we often refer to as the Islamic Empire was an Arab empire, was religiously and racially stratified. So Arab Muslims were at the top, and everybody else had to keep to their quarters, had to work for the empire, but was not necessarily welcome to the club. And so much of the push to allow for conversion came from the eastern provinces, where slave soldiers had been very active in the army and reached their glass ceiling of religious belonging. And they were not able to further go up in the ranks because they were not Muslims. And so that's how in the early 8th century we start having more concessions for individuals to convert to Islam. So when we look any further than Khorasan, or Afghanistan, conversion was really almost exclusively a trade-related phenomenon. And it's also through trade that we have this back and forth communication and exchanges on material culture. I keep going back to material culture because I find that very, very powerful to understand so much of the dynamics that that I try to flesh out in the book. And I don't know, maybe the book cover also conveys that the kind of approach. So without trade, without exchanges along commercial and aesthetic ideas, I don't think that we would, I think things would have proceeded in a very different way if we could make history with ifs.
And since you've brought up material culture, I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit more, because I definitely enjoyed your conversations about it. And really, I think, what was this interesting conversation with what was like localized cultural aesthetic and what was, I think, in some ways like seen as foreign, but foreign still, but maybe pivoting towards what was seen as an authentic Islamic aesthetic. So what was kind of that dynamic? And you had great examples, I think, from China, Java, Indonesia, Siam or Thailand and Central Asia. So many. So obviously we can't talk about all of them. But is there one that particularly stands out for you in terms of this exemplar of the dynamic that of Islam developing in this region and how that manifested in maybe a sacred space or other material culture?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for picking up on that. I think I might need two examples if I don't speak too long on the first one, but also this illustrates some of the process and the myth, going back to the methodology that we were talking about earlier. When I started really focusing on writing and conceptualizing the book, I was on a mini sabbatical in Singapore, and I was wandering around the then newly renovated galleries of the Asia Civilization Museum. And I just stumbled upon this white and blue plate from China, which had the Shahada inscribed and was decorated with pagodas and flowers. And to me, it was one of those aha moments that I also look for in my students whenever I take them to our campus museum, walking around the West Asia galleries. This aha moment in seeing everything that I've been trying to put together crystallize in an object. And so this is, to me, was a story of the of Muslim blue, as that specific tone of blue had come to be known in Ming China. That really brought everything together. So it had a dimension of intra-Asia connections through trade, but not trade that happened in a vacuum. It was trade that happened as individual merchants who happen to be Muslim were looking for solutions to a business issue through their lens as Muslims, because they wanted to sell more. Where in West Asia, where political shifts had led to an expansion of what today we would call the middle class. So people were buying luxury goods coming from China, but they had specific sensitivities, aesthetic and religious sensitivities. So they couldn't care for the very refined Song Dynasty monochromatic earthware. They just didn't like it. They were used to beautiful colored earthware. And so this is how cobalt came to China from Anatolia and what is today Afghanistan, and was put to use by Chinese kilners to produce this amazingly fine porcelain that, incidentally, kilners in West Asia had not been able to achieve because their ovens were not hot enough. But adapting it and using designs that have been brought in from West Asia, is sort of mirroring calligraphic art and some other, sometimes it's geometrical or vine arabesque-like motifs. And so having everything come together in this material experience and experiment, in fact, that was so successful that ultimately we have the Ming vase is so quintessentially Chinese that we talk about Xinhua City when we think about the Death Blue or other re-implementations of the white and blue ceramics into Europe, in Holland as well as Italy and England, for example. So to me, this was the this is the kind of entry points that I look for, that I looked for as I anchor myself in images, and I anchored a book on images and material culture. And so you mentioned specifically sacred spaces. Chapter two is largely addresses this idea of becoming Muslim as an individual, but also as space, as artists decorate, artists and general military commanders decorate these sacred spaces, and but also scholars write books, culturally translating Islamic law in local frameworks. And this is where I also hope to make a theoretical intervention in the way in which we think about the conversation between the foreign and the local. I think that the terms syncretism, hybridity, have been so overused, and we got so used to using the term syncretism without thinking too much about the implications. And when we do, then we shift, oh, let's just talk about hybridity because it sounds more neutral. But Stuart and Ernst have this amazing short piece flashing out why it's problematic to think about hybridity in terms of cultural and specifically religious terms, because a hybrid cannot reproduce itself and assumes pure ancestry. And so we are assuming that there is a pure Islam and there is a pure Confucian, Hindu, Buddhist, animist, whatever substratum that meet and create something that we can recognize as a thing per se, but cannot reproduce itself, is so specific that it lives as long as it can live and then it disappears. So what I'm trying to do with this chapter is to really to think beyond that. And there, Barry Flood's idea of transculturation really comes in handy, I think, in terms about this conversation that is a translation that doesn't leave anything behind. It kind of it embodies everything. And again, we see it in architecture, and we see it in the way in which Islamic law treaties are written, or poems are written. And again, it's still there and happens everywhere, not just in Asia, but also in Arabia, during Muhammad's lifetime, in which this conversation between the local and the foreign, even though on very different scale, still exists. So the way in which the Hajj ritual has come to be what is practiced today was a process of conversations, was a conversation process between various practices that were happening in Mecca and around Mecca in the 7th century. And similarly, the way that we see mosques being built today, we assume that the dome and minarets are what define, at least from the outside, what architecturally define a mosque as in its most authentic and pure standardized version. But that as and of itself drew so much from other experiences, both from religious and, in fact, secular architecture in the early years of the empire, of the Arab and Islamic empires. So it's really important to keep in mind this, this conversation between local and the foreign exists everywhere. It exists in Damascus and in Fustat as well as in Java or Xi'an in China. And so we see a mosque that looks like a pagoda and we think, oh, that's syncretic. That's a local adaptation. But we look at a mosque that has a dome and four minarets and we think that that's standard. But in fact, that is also the outcome of, is also a form of local adaptation.
I love that framing. I think one of the things I wrote down in my notes was this phrase that we had, a conversation and convergence, be it between law and the soul. So I think this is a conversation that was happening between the practice of Sufism and the fiqh tradition, or was it, between the spread of political Islamism or in practices around, gender and women's body. And I think this kind of spread that you weave throughout and getting us to think and moving away from what you excellently, said about the criticisms around hybridity and syncretism towards thinking about convergence, conversations, and flows was really productive. And I really appreciated that. And I was taking a lot of notes on that as well as I was writing and reading the book. Can you say a little bit more about maybe this kind of dynamic and these conversations around maybe Sufism particularly, mainly because I'm interested in it? And
how... I thought you might have been keen on
that. I'm totally projecting. But, one of the things that you do talk about throughout the book, it's in the book, is on Sufism. And really kind of similar dynamics in terms of questions of authenticity, right? And questions of law and who's allowed to do what, right? And I think it comes up in all these different conversations, but Sufism and I think gender was these two kind of dynamics that we'll read throughout the book that I saw coming up a lot.
Yeah, so I thought that might be picked up in today's conversation. Again, going back to this idea of breaking some strongly held dichotomies, the center, periphery, authentic, derivative, if not deviationist, there is definitely a good old dichotomy between the tariqa and the sharia, the path of the soul and the path of the law, as if these two things existed, these two approaches existed as separate one from the other, if not in opposition one to the other. And there is, this is definitely not something I specialize on specifically, but there is amazing literature out there, some of which has been featured on the New Books in Islamic Studies podcast, really trying to undo this dichotomy. And so I was very interested in trying to break down the conversation and convergence, indeed, between the law and the soul, or the path of the law and the path of the soul, in a way that it could be easily understood. Because I find that, again, thinking about my classroom experience, when students come in on day one of my Islam in Asia class, which is really now called something else that is more marketable and attractive to students rather than Islam in Asia. I did not change the syllabus. I just changed the title, and enrollments just skyrocketed just by calling controversy and debate in Islam. So we spent the very first session. I asked them, what do you think are the hottest debates within Islam or controversies within Islam? What do you know about Islam? And, people will say, there are some Muslims who are very spiritual, the Sufis, the whirling dervishes. And then there are people who are really close to the scriptures and these are two ways of being Muslim. And so I was Abdul Wahhab, and Wahhabism often comes up as a quintessential example of putative and perceived scriptural orthodoxy, whatever orthodoxy or orthopraxy mean. versus, again, the whirling dervishes of Konya. So I found talking about the Naqshbandiya extremely productive, and to think about and talk about Sufi tariqas that embrace, but in fact require and kind of propose and uphold the thinking that following the example of the prophet or following the example of the sheikhs is not, doesn't mean jettisoning the law. In fact, if we take the hadith as the source of behavior, then that also includes legal practice. Of course, this is also one specific way of thinking about Sufism that is not necessarily applicable to every single tariqah, and to Sufi Muslims who don't necessarily belong to tariqah. So when I bring in examples, I know that what I'm trying to say is often specific, but the Naqshbandiya is a very large and impactful phenomenon. They're not the only tariqah going back to this, to the importance of the hadith as being having multiple uses, let's say, in the experience of the seeker. And so in a sense, going also back to Abdul Wahhab, for me it was interesting to bring in Abdul Wahhab in this conversation on Sufism and Islamic law, and saying, so one of the individuals that we feel that we can put the finger on by saying he was a scripturalist, he only believed that we should apply Islamic law as understood in a certain way, the scriptures understood in a certain way, in fact was deeply influenced by Sufism, had been called, also referred to as a teacher by others, and followed individuals who were very well known and affirmed as Sufi scholars, Sufi sheikhs. So again, going on and trying to undo some of these assumptions, but the example of Naqshbandiya to me does, and for the book, does also a number of other things beyond the, you know, unhinging. And I'm very fond of the term unhinging. I know that it has a connotation of kind of being deranged, being a little out of it. But I think that thinking about unhinging these dichotomies does create discomfort in many of those who hold to them very strong. So and so kind of trying to unpack this dichotomy, it also points at the influence that Muslims from Asia have had through the centuries, not just in Asia, but all over the world. The Naqshbandiya today is present everywhere, including North America and Australia. But as early, you know, in the 15th century, and it starts off in Central Asia with a concern for the degradation of Muslims' practices. And so it has the same drive that many of the scripturalist reformers would have. So this focus on silence zikr and Islamic law, and then shortly after gets brought, gets taken out of Central Asia, both east and west. And so it reaches the Tarim Basin and the Fergana Valley on the east side, and reaches the Ottoman Empire on the west. By the 17th century, we have Naqshbandi sheikhs being popular in the sense of influential and gathering many students in India, in the subcontinent, and in Mecca. And so we have this further move from Central South Asia towards the West to Mecca as a hub for Muslims all over the world who would come there to learn and study, attracted by the historical devotional importance that Mecca holds, but also becoming a receptacle for for Muslims with very different, with a variety of life experiences and geographical origins. And so we have Arab scholars and non-Arab scholars learning and studying the Naqshbandi way, and then going further out again onto, for example, Southeast Asia. And so the Naqshbandiya becomes a really important way to look at the dynamic movement across Asia, out of Asia, and back into Asia of Muslims, and the role of Asian Muslims in shaping Islamic understanding and Islamic practices at the so-called center. And the fact that orthodoxy or orthopraxy might look different in different places is contextual. And here also I lean heavily on Ahmed Shahab's work on Muslim meaning-making, right? How can we define a standard orthodoxy or a standard orthopraxy? And he brings, again, this conversation between the trans-regional and global and the local as in of itself, because the Naqshbandiya stays as one tariqa, but also has many manifestations across across the globe.
I'm really mindful of your time since you've given us so much of it. So I wonder if in wrapping up, I'm really interested because in your thoughts of how you would deploy this book in a classroom. You wrote it for that intention for your students in mind, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners or even myself would think of using sections of it or maybe the whole book in, you know, the classes that we teach on Islam. So do you have any advice for us in terms of how that could go about?
Oh, yes, I have plenty of advice on how I think you can use my book in your classes.
Yeah.
No, but so I think there are maybe, two or three straightforward ways that the material here could be used. One, honestly, just as a textbook, and I personally, especially as probably 2020, 2021, is likely to look, it's extremely likely to be going in remote in some form. I think it's going to be really helpful to have one book that students can refer back to. So I'll be readjusting my syllabus to mirror more the structure of the book. But I mean, in class, I would be saying the same things that I've written in the book. So for me, that's kind of obvious. Barring that, there are two things that could be done. Each chapter starts with an illustration and is usually paired either immediately or further in by primary source. And so I think that this combination, or even individually, the illustration and the quote and or source could be very well deployed either to start a conversation at the beginning of class, to show an image and ask students what themes, what ideas, what feelings the image brings up, but also as a prompt for students' reflections, sort of for a think, pair, share in-class activity or for a journal activity. I'm very fond of this kind of activities in the class as I try to not talk and lecture for 45 minutes. I'm sure you gather that I love talking, as most of us do. I don't think that students can really, as we can't, also as colleagues and scholars, really listen to someone straight for 45 minutes or 75 minutes for that matter. And so using these, deploying these illustrations and primary sources as conversation starters or for reflection prompts. And then another way is each chapter is really meant to be self-standing. Of course, there are cross-references across the book, but I've also written each chapter thinking that it could be used as an individual reading. It has, each chapter has a section for further readings, which are usually the books that for me have been most influential in writing the chapter, but also that could be good avenues for further expanding some of the themes that I touch upon. Or I try to not to have a narrative that is too heavy on theoretical debates, but sometimes I put books in the further reading sections that they're actually exploring the theoretical debates in more depth. And so I can imagine various chapters working for courses that might be widely different one from the other. I mean, we're just talking about Naqshbandiya networks, and of course that can work, I think, very well for a course that focuses on Sufism, but also a course that focuses on Islamic law, for example. Chapter 6, which is titled New Imaginations of Piety and focuses on the 1960s and 1990s, could be for a class on political Islam, but also on religious minorities, as the second half of the book, of this specific chapter, explores religious minority settings. There is a whole chapter on Islam as resistance, chapter 7, which really looks at the anti-Soviet resistance in Afghanistan starting in 1979, and then thinks in different ways about jihad. And this could be even used in a course on U.S. foreign policy, in fact, because there is so much that is still going on related related to Afghanistan that goes back to those years, to the 1980s, for example. I would love to see the early chapters of the book on the Islamic, Islam across the Oxus or becoming Muslim being incorporated in Islamic Civ, very traditional modules, as I think that they are a lot more approachable in the way they're written than Marshall Hodgson's The Venture of Islam or even Ira Lapidus' text, which I personally use as an undergraduate student in Italian translation. But I find that sometimes the level of detail that it goes into, so one is extremely detailed, the other one is extremely theoretical, it might be daunting one way or another for undergraduate students. So these are just some of the ways that I think it could work.
I mean, you've done a great service for those of us who teach Islam in any capacity for undergrad students and even for grad students. So it's like phenomenal. And I know myself and many others would be really, really grateful and thankful to have your book to be able to utilize in the classroom. As we wrap up our time, I wonder if you could let us know, I mean, hopefully you're taking a break after you've written this amazing book, but are there things that you're thinking about or maybe have hoping to be working on when things are settled, if ever? What are new projects on the horizon?
Right. So, no, of course, there is no resting. All of the last phase of this book happened during sabbatical. So I've been on sabbatical for the whole academic year, which was great. And a little disappointing because, of course, with the current pandemic situation, I haven't been able to do much of the traveling and archival research that I wanted to do. But it's been intellectually very stimulating nonetheless. So I have one project that is in the pipeline and is very closely related to Islam in Asia, which is the Routledge Handbook of Islam in Asia. Which I'm editing, and I have some amazing contributors I'm working with, including, of course, you and a bunch of other people who have been featured on the podcast. So I'm really excited, going back to the earlier conversation about, how timely the debate is in scholarly terms about what is Islamic studies. I'm really hoping that even though we are at the very early stages of the handbook, that this can contribute to that conversation even further. I'm also working on a project that is much more into my usual comfort zone of colonial Java and Sumatra. This is a little bit of a jumble, but I think I have a 1 or 2 minute pitch that I can try, even though, I'm a total post-sabbatical chaos of everything's interesting. I want to do everything kind of thing. But What I'm trying to look at is ways in which modernity was framed as connected to ideas and ideals, in fact, of hygiene, health, and nutrition in colonial Indonesia. But I also see a continuity from the colonial Dutch authority onto the Japanese occupation and the early post-colonial Republican years. And I am partly as an outcome of this project, which got me a lot more to read a lot more on women's studies and gender studies. My focus here is going to be on the role of women in executing these modernizing policies in the homes and in the villages first, but then also becoming extremely important on the public sphere because of the rather surprising but also necessary role of the Japanese occupation authority that had sent most of the men either to work to build railways or to die on the on the battlefield, and so only Javanese women and Sumatran women were left behind. They were trained as nurses, midwives, but also doctors and nutritionists, and so creating this this cohort of highly or fairly highly trained women who then become executors of Republican policies of health and the modernizing developmentalist agenda. So deploying their field of expertise that would have been labeled as domestic and traditional as in fact for and within the structures of the state and state institutions for the practical and institutionalized modernization of the state. There's a lot of food talk. There is a lot of discussion on what modern motherhood looked like for indigenous middle class women in Java and Sumatra in relation to traditional practices. There is Islam, which is sort of everywhere in the book and nowhere specific because it interacted the whole time, going back to these ideal conversations with Western frames of modernity, but also in shaping early manifestations and early surfacing of halal claims for processed foods. And we go back to the fact there is a lot of food talk and hygiene and how we go from really the mantra of hygiene, health, and move on to halal in the 1920s, 1930s, Java.
That sounds very exciting. I hope I get to talk to you about that. And I'm very also excited, needless to say, of being involved at the handbook as well. So thank you so much for the opportunity. I'm so grateful for our time, especially considering the circumstances. And I know you have so much going on. So thank you so much. And also your family for making this possible for us to have a conversation.
Thank you.
And I look forward to future conversations. Thank you again so much for joining us.
Absolutely. It was a great pleasure. And it was great to have a good reason to go back to the book after I haven't been wanting to look at it since I had to go through the proofs.
It's a fantastic book. And everyone's going to be excited about it. So I'm really happy we got to chat about it. Thank you.
And that was my conversation with Professor Chiara Formichi about her new book, Islam in Asia, A History. Thank you so much for joining us and listening to our podcast as always. And I wish you much safety and good health in the days ahead. Take good care.